Welcome back to Beyond the Headline, everyone. I'm so excited to have you on the show today because I'm here with Jack Altman, the co-founder and CEO of Lattice. Jack, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'd love to start out with one of the insights that you guys actually have on the site, that Lattice is modern performance management. It's super simple, but I think it's a great description of what you guys do because performance reviews and goal settings continue to be really anchored in the past. Can you introduce us to the work you guys are doing and what makes it so special?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the core of what we are hoping to accomplish at Lattice is replacing what has been sort of a core but challenging aspect of the way that you manage employees at work. Traditionally, this has been done through what people kind of know as the annual performance review, where sort of once a year, you'll kind of get together with your manager, you'll go through a ton of questions about what was your performance, how did you do against your goals, maybe what did your peers or your direct reports think about you. It becomes this big, scary process that's then, tied up with a lot of compensation questions and, are you just thinking about what I did in the last month or are you actually looking back at the whole year? And for a lot of these reasons, it's been something that, employees kind of hate. Companies don't see a lot of value out of. I think I just saw the other day that, even Amazon now, who's obviously a leader in terms of the way they think about management, is going to kind of try to move away from this annual performance review. We've seen other great companies like GE and Intel sort of move away from this process. And I think the reason that we sort of see this is because it's just something that doesn't work that well. And so we've been trying to figure out, okay, what does it take to do that stuff? There's obviously value there. How do we still give employees the feedback they need, help them set the goals that they need to be successful, have an honest sort of appraisal of how employees are doing, but do it in a way that suits sort of the new world. And so our answer to that has to do with being more continuous, being more transparent, and kind of doing it in a way that's more flexible for the way employees really work. And the way employees work is not, scheduling their year plan on January 1st, and then checking back in a year later. The world's become so much more dynamic than that. Communication is light speed. We have Slack and, we've got, people are working over email and people are communicating face to face, or they're using, Skype like you and I are right now. And because of this, I think people want to get their feedback more continuously. And so our job at Lattice is to basically give people a way to get the value from performance management, which has a lot of value, but give them a new structure so that it doesn't come with all of those negative baggages. And so that's what we're trying to do. And so, whether it's, addressing the way that you set your goals and making sure you do those more often, or whether it's making sure that feedback comes more freely and more clearly, and then giving you ways to track and, sort of aggregate all of that, that's what I think we can do. And, if we can basically take an important but broken process that's core to employee management, then I think we'll be able to, add a lot of value to companies.
I love the continuous aspect too, because for each of those elements, whether it's goals or performance reviews, when you meet once a year, so much is forgotten and lost.
That's right. And, it might be the case that, you look back and you're saying, man, I remember that this person did a great job on that project, but I can't exactly remember what it was. And it was back in January and now it's November. And you see that all the time, that, people are human and you just can't actually remember that past. And there's this huge recency bias. And so, even if you're doing your reviews biannually or even quarterly, I think that recency bias is just, it's just so powerful. And so that's a big reason why I think this is so valuable. And then at the same time, I think for employees to hear on a more regular basis how they're doing. And by the way, this goes for whether, it's within our software or inside the employee's culture. I think for employees, people want to get better. People want feedback. Like, people want to hear from people who either know more than them or just are able to observe their work from an outside perspective so that they can get better. And like, people crave this sort of feedback. And so it's not just more fair. It's also something that employees really want and desire.
What products are most popular? What are people most eager to get started with?
It really depends. So as you know, we've got, a couple sort of modules inside of what we look at as the overall performance review product. And so there's goals, and there's sort of this ongoing check-in feedback product, and then there's more traditional sort of reviews, which can either be done as informal 360s or more traditional, you know, manager reviews. And so it really depends on the company. We'll sometimes have companies who will come to us and say, hey, you know, we've been tracking our goals and OKRs in spreadsheets, and it's just too messy now, and that's really what we need to fix because we can't keep track of them. They're getting lost. Employees aren't engaging with them. And so they'll start with goals, and then they'll realize that it's actually really valuable to tie their performance reviews in later, and so maybe a quarter later they'll do that. We also have cases where it goes the other way, where a company is running their performance review next week or next month, and last year what they did was sent out a Google form to, you know, 150 or 250 employees, and they tried to track all of their peers, and they tried to, you know, chase everybody down, and they're like, we just can't do it again. It took us, you know, too many dozens of hours to do it all. So they'll start with that, and then maybe goals will come later. Or sometimes we'll have a company that says, we want to do performance management the right way next year. And, you know, we believe in all of these things. We've tried them. And so we're just going to do it all. And so we kind of see all of it. And it really just depends on sort of the company.
Can you tell us a story about one of your customers and how using Lattice impacted them?
Yeah, definitely. I can give you two, maybe one on sort of each side. One of the awesome things that we see on the goals side is, while setting up goals, I think a lot of the value with goal setting comes during the actual setup process. And so when you think about why do people set goals and what's the value there, there's sort of a few aspects. One is the sort of personal psychological elements of, when I set out to do something and I declare that to the world, you know, I'm going to be more accountable to it, and I'm going to hold myself to sort of getting there. And so one of the things that I think is really powerful is people setting these kind of ambitious goals and getting there. But then this whole other aspect, and why we think it's valuable to use Lattice across a company, is because you get this alignment sense. So I remember, you know, one of the things we do with our customers when we get started is, you know, me or someone else from the team will go in and meet with the executive team and spend an hour kind of talking about goals, talking about Lattice and sort of how they can get set up. And we had a customer who, at that sort of exec kickoff meeting of goals for the next quarter, said, hey, this you know, department goal of mine has really nothing to do with any of the company goals. And, you know, it's not until just this meeting that I realized it. And within 5 minutes, everybody basically just said, let's kill your whole initiative and let's do something that ties to the company goal. And it was actually just a matter of realizing these are the company goals. It's now all out in the open in this very clear way. And one of the executives there realized that, you know, what her department was working on just didn't make any sense relative to those goals. And without any sort of, there was nothing negative. There was no bad emotion about it. It was just, great, we all see this doesn't align. Let's kill it and refigure out what this looks like. And so that was cool to see that, you know, 15 minutes in, we were able to, you know, make people realize that, you know, by just laying this out, which is something surprisingly few companies actually spend the time doing, you can realize that the work you're doing has nothing to do with what you actually are trying to achieve as a company. And so something there needs to get misaligned. And then on the review side, I think, you know, the gratifying thing we'll hear is when, you know, typically an HR leader will tell us, hey, you know, doing reviews last year took me so many countless hours. It was such a headache. You know, I dropped forms, I lost these things, I had no analytics. And now using this kind of product has allowed me to literally set up my review and launch it in like less than 15 minutes. Wow. And then after that, I've got analytics, I've got a history of it. People can share it with their employees. And so that's awesome for us. Just to saving people time is like always one of the things that I think software can do best. And so hearing that like directly is really gratifying for me.
And how does that goal setting aspect, Jack, change as the company grows? You experienced that at Teespring, you know, joining when it was a very small team and then up to 400 people. What is that like?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think there are different phases and sort of different orders of magnitude at which companies get really different. And the way that companies have to operate becomes really different. And so when you're 10 people and 50 people and 200 people and then 500 or 1500, at each of these stages, it's, I think, more different than people would expect how the company actually operates. And so, you know, just some quick examples to illustrate. At 10 people, you usually all work in the same room. And at any given time, somebody in the room could stand up, see all of their coworkers at once and talk at, you know, and, you know, with an inside voice, and everybody would hear what they say. So alignment comes extremely easily at that stage. You then break sort of this 50 to 80 person kind of size, and that's where you no longer know everybody. You maybe, you know, a new employee came in that you weren't even aware was talking to the company. Maybe there's a few people you see that you don't know their names anymore. And so you sort of have to transition from this, you know, what I call like a, you know, team slash family dynamic to more of, you know, hopefully what becomes more of a sports team dynamic where you're definitely on a team, but it's, you know, it's getting a little bit more professional and it's getting a little bit more, you know, about, you know, a little bit less family and a little bit more, we are like a sports team. And then 150 and above, you totally lose that. You know, you hear numbers like 150 is where the maximum number of relationships anybody can have. And so I think that goes for a company, and you really, really viscerally feel that when you get to a company that size. And so at each of these stages, and then of course, you know, at 500, it's very different again, where you are now not thinking in terms of individuals, but you're thinking in terms of teams and departments, and how does product work with design? You know, how does sales work with customer success, and how does, you know, their feedback get processed through product, and the ways that you think you have to basically sort of sum up the people and the teams into building blocks so that you can get your mind around it again, because you just can't wrap your head around 500 moving parts. So you have to sort of think in sort of a new dynamic. And, you know, I've never worked at, you know, a 50,000 person company, but I imagine it just continues to sort of block up that way. And so in terms of goal setting, the values that you get from goal setting, I think, increase actually at each of those stages. And the reason for that is goals do two things. One is they give individuals a better way to set their own ambitions, to track what they're doing, to kind of, you know, aim more aggressively and to be transparent to others about what they're working on. At the same time, though, I think goals allow a company to be aligned and for people to see, hey, even though I might not know everybody at this 500-person company, I know what my work is and I know how it ties into the bigger picture. And if I need to, I can see what marketing's main initiatives are. And I'll know that, you know, hey, my work actually is very tied to this marketing department's objectives and I should be working with them. And so increasing that transparency and alignment becomes more important the bigger the company gets. And because that's one of the things goals does, I think it actually becomes more and more valuable over time. That said, I don't think there's a size where it's not valuable. Lattice is a small company and we obviously use goals ourselves, but I think where you really start to feel it is, you know, 30 to 50 employees when you're sort of starting to make that first transition and you need to work at alignment, and that's where goals become really valuable.
I love that you share that, and also the example of someone understanding where their goal fits in with the rest of the company, because that's something I was going to ask you, is how do you transition with someone who has been there from day one and now the company's 50 people or 100 people? They're not used to reporting their goals. That's something that maybe you talked on one-on-one.
That's right. And the other challenging thing with that growth, by the way, is that you'll have a lot of people who join a company very early. And one of the reasons that they were willing and exciting to join a 10-person company is necessarily at odds with the realities of how a company has to run when you're 100 people. And this is something that I think a lot of early startup employees find challenging. I've certainly seen this in, you know, my own experience and talking to friends of mine who have, you know, been early employees and gone through hypergrowth. The way that, you know, a company works when you're 10 people and the way a company works when you're 100 or 1,000 are really, really different. And, you know, a lot of the attraction of joining an early stage startup is you don't have a lot of process and you do have a lot of autonomy. One of the ways I always think about it is no matter what size company you are, there's a certain number of jobs that have to be done, whether those jobs are producing content or, you know, talking to customers or designing product or building a product or, you know, handling data or managing finances. There's kind of a certain number of jobs. And so when you have fewer people than that number of jobs, let's say that number of jobs is 50. If you have 8 people, then everybody's going to need to do 6 jobs. And that's, you know, some people find that really appealing to wear lots of hats. And then, you know, maybe when you have 500 people, you've got 10 people per job. And so that's why you build teams, because each job has now gotten harder. But fundamentally, you know, they're still in some ways, these are the jobs, they've just gotten harder. And so, you know, being part of a team that does, say, you know, content marketing versus your job being content marketing, you know, digital marketing, as well as, you know, maybe randomly you also, you know, manage finances because the team is so small that you're wearing that, you know, disparate of hats. And I've seen examples like that where people are doing crazily different things. A lot of these things that are appealing in the early days just go away naturally. And so I think this is a challenge for companies, is how do you help those employees stay engaged and stay happy, you know, when they're now working at a company that looks really, really different than what they joined out of necessity. I think there's like a lot of techniques for this. I think most of them come down, like, in general, I think communication is the best way to handle anything of this nature. But a lot of it is just communication and, you know, talking with the employee, you know, very, very honestly about this is the new reality of it. And, you know, this is what it takes to be successful. And, you know, a big reason I think people, you know, can make that transition is because they want what's best for the company. They care about it deeply. They were there from the beginning. And, you know, you and I talked about this earlier. When you see something from the beginning, you care about it. And so I think finding those sorts of ways to encourage employees that this is what's best for this company that they really care about, I think that's how you get people through it.
And how did it feel for you, whether now or at Teespring, when your role, it's always interesting with scaling because your role actually ends up getting smaller. How has that felt for you?
Totally. That's a great way to put it. Your role does always get smaller. And, you know, there was a great article about, you know, giving away your Legos.
I was just going to say, I think everyone knows Molly's article.
Yeah. It's just so perfect. I use that phrase all the time. And when I read it, I was like, this, you know, and now it sounds like a game. This is great. And so for me at Teespring, I certainly went through that. Currently at Lattice, I'm certainly going through that, where you're doing, you know, many, many jobs. And then what you ideally do as you scale is you give one of those jobs away to somebody who's better than you at that job. And that feels really good because you now have one fewer job to do, which means, you know, you only have 100% of your time. And so if you can take 10% of that away, that means you can do a better job on everything else. And so you simultaneously get to level up the quality on that job while you get to work more on the other ones. And so I think this is all framing. I think so much of life is, you know, the way that you frame it in your own head, and the way that you think about things, and the way you decide to feel about them. So rather than saying, oh man, I used to do all of these things and now I only get to do, you know, this many things, instead you say, this is great. I get to focus more on the things that I'm best at and that I like, hopefully. You know, I get to see someone else at the company succeed and do something great at what they're doing. And so when I was at Teespring, whether that was, you know, hiring somebody to, take over sort of, you know, a partnerships effort or sort of a corporate development effort or build a new sales function, or now at Lattice, as, you know, we're starting to scale and we're building out different departments and, we're, you know, bringing in new people to do things that historically I've done. Thinking of it through that lens of being happy to give away your Legos because it's best for the company and it means you get to spend more time working on what you love, that makes me really excited and happy about it.
What's the most unexpected thing so far that's happened at Lattice?
For me, it has been learning how to do real customer development. And by that I mean seeing how users are using your product and digging into what's actually going on. And so when you release a new product, which, you know, Lattice is my first company, and so we just launched in May. I can't believe it, but it's only been 6 months.
It feels like forever.
it feels like forever times two. And so we launched this goals product. That was what came first. And we saw it widely disparate people using it, different functions, different team sizes, different roles. And we didn't, you know, you just see people using it, and you're like, this is so exciting, people are using our product. And then you start talking to the customers and you ask them, like, why are you using this? What are you hoping to get from this? Like, why did you start? What made you come here? What were you hoping to get out of it? And what are you getting out of it? And what we quickly realized, actually, and by quickly, I mean over the course of maybe a month and, you know, a couple hundred customer conversations. So it didn't feel that quick. But what we realized is that there were these two very different ways people were thinking about goals. And we had kind of discussed this, but we hadn't necessarily gone all the way into it. And one side was that goals are the sort of foundation of productivity. Goals are the thing that you want to accomplish. They're, you know, they're launching a new product. And so what I need to do from that goal is to break it down into the component parts and then all the way down into the daily tasks. And so we had a group of people who were using goals as the anchor of productivity. Here's what I want to get, and then I'm going to break that down into steps and a recipe for how I'm going to get there. And then on the other side, we had people who were using goals as a way to track employee success. And so maybe they have that same goal to launch this product, but their plan was to then at the end of the quarter or whatever period they were in, to talk with that employee about how it went, why did it go well, why did it go badly, what can we do better next time, was the goal ambitious enough? And even though we saw employees inputting those same goals, it wasn't until talking to customers that we realized that there were these really fundamentally different ways people were thinking about it. One was productivity and one was employee management. And so what we had talked about before but never addressed so head on with real humans using our product was that goals do have this overlap between daily productivity and long-term employee development and performance. And so really feeling that difference and then needing to work on teasing out that difference and not, you know, we weren't able to just say, oh yeah, goals are kind of part of this. We as the builders of Lattice need to, like, that's the kind of thing that we have to understand very deeply. Like, we have to really get, when is a goal part of productivity? When is it part of employee development? When is it part of both? And how do those overlap? And so, of course, you know, since then, as the product has developed and we've built more tools that are around employee management or things like performance reviews and feedback, you know, you can tell that we decided to go that way rather than going towards sort of tasks and productivity. But learning that employees using your product in the same way don't necessarily have the same objectives was super surprising for me, because before, if you had asked me if two employees typed in the, you know, exact same goal and did, you know, some of the exact same behaviors, I would have not thought that there could be such disparate uses that are truly so different.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because it ties into an insight that you shared in your Product Hunt Live that I really loved about customers, especially in the early days, being really willing to actually help you build and shape your product. When did you realize that they wanted to be a part of the process with you?
That's honestly been my most, it's probably been my favorite part, I think, of the product development process, is that a surprising number of people will go so deep, you can't believe how deeply they'll go into helping you with your product. And whether or not what they're giving you, the advice they're giving you is, you know, in line with what you should be doing, sometimes it's off track. Sometimes it's the most valuable advice you've heard in a month. You know, sometimes it will make every other piece of advice you've heard from all of your, you know, investors and friends pale in comparison to this extremely useful user insight. But regardless of whether it's useful or not, the way that people have been willing to write out, you know, crazily long, and this is without ever meeting us, they'll write out these crazily long explanations with screenshots that they took and annotations about, here's how I think you could improve the product and here's why I'm using it and this is what I'd like to see and what I think will help you. It's amazing. And so I think so much of that is just the Silicon Valley community, for some reason, and it's, like, obviously powerful, and I, you know, it's probably a longer conversation about what makes this particular community so willing to help without expectation so often. Something about that, though, I've really, really felt that, and it's really resonant. And, you know, at our stage still, we'll have, you know, our customers will come on, and even, you know, occasionally we'll have a lawyer at a customer say, hey, I think if you drafted your customer agreements this way, you'll be able to do this better. And I'm like, you didn't need to help me with that.
That's so nice.
And it's so nice. And they're doing it for no reason other than to just try to be helpful. And I, you know, I even asked like, why I do this? And he's like, oh, you know, I've been doing this for a lot of years. And I know you guys are a young startup and we like your product and we want to see you succeed. And I thought this would help out. And I'm like, that's just so generous. And then, you know, it's like an overwhelming amount of help from, you know, customers or prospective users in terms of the feedback they give. And I've loved it.
You mentioned getting really valuable piece of advice that sometimes overshadow things that you guys had previously thought. What's the most valuable piece of advice you got? Not this month, like October and half of November, since we're only midway.
I mean, so what I would say is like the advice that I get from users and sort of the people who are, you know, maybe don't know me personally, but just are, you know, they want Lattice to work either for them or for just because they're people who like to be helpful. The advice that they give me is very directed, very thoughtful, and sometimes they don't even realize how insightful, I think, product advice. And so it can be things like they will identify a connection that should be happening between our goals and reviews product that we hadn't thought of, but that strengthens the overall product very well. And so I think for us, since we just launched reviews, I guess now it's been literally 1 month. So we launched reviews a month ago, which has been a whirlwind month because, you know, we've kind of since launching that we've realized how valuable that is to people. And the feedback that we've gotten from customers has very aggressively dictated what we try to build. And so I think this part of this goes back to Y Combinator of, you know, one of the sort of tenets there is listening to your users. And so we're really, really focused on listening to what our users tell us. And so one distinction I want to make here is when a user says, I want this feature, don't just build that feature. And this is something that, you know, takes learning. And, you know, certainly, you know, I still need to get better at. But the sort of rule of thumb I have is that you can't ask why too many times. Like, you should always be saying, well, why do you want that feature? And they'll say, because I want to do this. And then you ask them, well, why do you want to do that? And you keep going down this rabbit hole until you get to the core need. And then maybe you realize that what they're feeling is, you know, I just don't have enough customizability here. And then, you know, or maybe what they're feeling is, it's too hard for me to see what's going on in a different department. And so when you hear feedback from customers, instead of just writing it down and saying thanks, try to engage them on the, you know, the core level of why are they asking for this? And then when you sort of aggregate all of that, you're able to see, you know, this is holistically the aspects of the product that people are feeling are lacking. And then let's address those. And I'm going to make a quick plug about a product called Product Board. I've never met the team there, but we started using their product within the last couple of months. And it's honestly been so helpful for us because it's designed specifically to allow you to capture customer feedback in a way that puts it in raw and then gives you a way to sort of turn that into features and then into sprints. And for us, it's just been so valuable to change that mindset from building what customers ask for to asking what they're really trying to accomplish, what they're really feeling, the pain that's not there, and then addressing it that way.
Such an important insight that you wish you could give a founder or startup team member on their first day of work and have them actually listen to you. I wish I would have internalized that.
Yes, that is the one. Like when I talk to other founders who are just getting started, this is, you know, definitely in the top three things that I say. If I could do it all over again, I would listen differently, and this is how I would listen.
Love that. I want to shift gears just a little bit, Jack, to your culture at Lattice. When you guys launched, you highlighted the importance for other teams, not just your own team, of feeling inspired when you're working together in an environment of growth. What does an environment of growth look like?
It's a great question. To me, there's a short list of things that actually make people happy. And I think this correlates very closely to productivity, because I think people who are happy at work are more engaged and ultimately are more productive. And so I think it is in everybody's interest. not just for personal happiness reasons, but also for business reasons, for people to be truly happy. And so there are a few of these, and I think growth is one of them. So I think one of the drivers of human happiness actually is just people feeling growth and progress. I think stagnation feels bad. I think people naturally, you know, maybe it's the hedonic treadmill, but for whatever reason, people want to feel progress, and that's fundamental to people. So I'll circle back to growth again, but so, you know, growth is one of these. I think the feeling of creation is a really valuable one for people. And so that doesn't have to mean starting a company, but putting out new things into the world, like what you do with podcasts, or, you know, maybe what somebody at a larger company does, spinning up, you know, a new team, or maybe if you're launching Uber in a new city, the feeling of saying nothing was here before and I made this thing and people enjoy it and get value from it, I think that is another thing that's very gratifying. I think one of the other drivers of happiness is essentially like a feeling of support, which can either come, you know, in your personal life. It's a feeling of, you know, having like loved ones who support you, or at work, it means feeling like there are people around you who care, who want you to get better, who want to see you succeed. And so these are some of the things that we think about a lot with Lattice, and how can we make our product, make companies have a culture where people are happier. And so growth is one of the biggest drivers. And so, you know, Paul Graham has this amazing essay, Startup Equals Growth. This is something my brother Sam talks about a lot, that growth is the absolute lifeblood of startups. And this is what will make, this is the one thing that can make almost every other problem go away, is growth. And until you're in those environments and you see how powerful of a sort of mechanic for company success growth is, it's almost hard to believe how many aspects it improves. So to give a couple examples, when a company is growing quickly, completely aside from sort of the feeling of like, you know, the employees thinking they're going to make more money, for example, which I don't actually think is like the big driver of happiness. When a company is growing, employees get to have their roles grow. For me at Teespring, I got to see, you know, as the company evolved from 15 people to 500, I got to go from an individual contributor to becoming a manager, to becoming a manager of managers. And at each phase, I learned a new thing and then got better at it. And then as soon as I was better at it, I got another challenge, and I got to keep stretching and seeing, you know, where did I break? And, you know, I got to push myself in a way that, you know, if the company never grew, I would have never learned that I was capable of doing more and, you know, doing something bigger. And so one of the beautiful things about, you know, a growth environment is that employees get to feel career growth. And so I think that's a big one. Another important part of growth for companies, I think, is that employees want to, like, feeling like you're part of something bigger than yourself has always been important, whether that's, you know, national pride, or whether that's part of a community, or, you know, extracurricular group, or, you know, a college, or any of these things. Being part of something bigger than yourself, people care about. And when that thing that you are bigger than is succeeding, you feel good. And, you know, you see this, you know, I'm not a sports fan, but I see people, you know, either crying or cheering over their sports team. And that's because they feel, when you feel that connected to this thing, you want it to succeed so badly. And so another part of it is just the morale that you get from people feeling like they're part of something that is growing and improving and doing well. It has a big thing. So I think it's both the personal development opportunity, and it's just the happiness employees get from being part of something that is on the right track.
My favorite part of that too, that you mentioned, is that you don't have to be a founder to make that impact.
Absolutely not. Yeah. I think there are all kind of ways to make this impact. I think founding a company is one of, you know, countless ways to impact. You could be an artist in the woods creating something beautiful. You could be an employee at a big company doing something new. You could be writing a book or creating, you know, interviews. You could be doing almost anything. And it doesn't have to do with starting something from, you know, starting a technology startup from scratch. That's, you know, a very small sliver of kind of what we're talking about here. And, you know, that's the world that, you know, I live in. So that's my perspective. But I see that I see that those are sort of the fundamental truths about it. And, you know, for example, you know, my fiance who works as a nurse practitioner, in her world, it's completely different, but all of these same dynamics apply. And, you know, for her growing in, you know, her career in this completely different field and the feeling of, you know, helping other people and, you know, feeling that sort of impact and being tied to sort of a profession that, you know, is very important. I think there are infinite ways to do this, but I think these core things remain true.
And one of the core things that you mentioned there and you have before is being around people who are also constantly trying to make themselves better. Who is one of those people for you and how do they influence you?
So for me, it's probably my brother, Sam. So I live with my two brothers as well as my fiance. Being surrounded by, you know, I think the five people you surround yourself with the most, the five people that you interact with the most, have a humongous impact on how you think about things. If you're surrounded by five people who all they talk about is, you know, sports and going out to bars, for example, versus if you are around five people who all they talk about is their jobs, or if you're around five people who all they talk about is literature and art. Not that any one of those things is better than the other, but you're very influenced by that, I think. And so the things that people around you care about, the way that they behave, has a big impact on you. And so for me, being around Sam in particular, who certainly out of all the people I've met in my life is the person who has sort of endless ambition and sort of no sense that there's anything that is too big for him to do or that he's not capable of, and not just thinks that way, but then acts that way and somehow does this, you know, seemingly impossible number of things at a time. Seems to scale up at jumps that, you know, people aren't typically accustomed to. You normally sort of grow in your career and take on bigger challenges at, you know, at a certain pace that Sam seems to ignore. And he'll just make these giant leaps constantly. And seeing that is just, I think, for me, a huge impact on, you know, if I ever tell myself, like, I can't do that, you know, I've got somebody who I can look at and be like, well, I should be able to.
I love that. Two more for you, even though I wish I could ask you like 10 more. The first one's serious, the second one not. When you think back on 2016, what's the most interesting thing you learned?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. And it's hard to answer because this is, you know, 2016 is a year that I, all of Lattice took place in 2016. And so I guess for me this year, so much, you know, there's different times in your life, I guess, when work and other things take up different percents of sort of the pie chart of your life. And I guess in this year, the biggest part of the pie chart of my life has been Lattice. So the learning is probably a Lattice learning. And I think starting a startup, the biggest learning is definitely about myself. I think starting a company is a lot more learning who you are than I anticipated. And part of that is, you know, I think I've generally lived, you know, a really fortunate life in a lot of ways. And starting a startup is really hard, no matter what, you know, things you've got at your disposal and no matter what advantages you have, it doesn't really change the fact that you need to go from nothing to a thing that people actually want. And getting there is really hard. And so and that was no different for us, and it still isn't. And going from the, oh man, I took this leap of faith on doing this thing, and it's now 5 months later, and we're still just, you know, a couple of founders trying to figure it out, and going through, you know, some darkness there where you're, you know, you're up at night thinking like, you know, is this right?
What are we gonna be able to,
what am I doing? Yeah, was this the right thing? I could have, you know, done, you know, X, Y, or Z. And taking myself through hardship, I think, has taught me just a lot about myself and how can I be resilient? Obviously, I know life tends to just get harder, I think, unfortunately. And so I'll probably do things and, you know, I'll go through things in my life that are a lot harder than starting Lattice. And so getting to put myself through, you know, some adversity here and some challenge. And, you know, it's not to say that this has been some, you know, horrifically difficult experience, but it is, you know, I also don't want to underplay that starting a startup's hard. And so seeing for myself how I react to difficulty, and then how do I get better at, in the face of a challenge, not letting it throw me off, and also maybe in the face of a win, not letting it pull me up too much. I think that's learning about myself has definitely been the biggest thing.
I love that. And I can't believe that actually ties into my last question, because this job was way harder than starting a startup. In August, you tweeted about your first 7 jobs. One of them was being a soccer ref. What is the best thing you learned there? And what was that experience like?
Oh gosh, what a question. Being a soccer ref. I mean, so I grew up in St. Louis, and I grew up in like a suburb of St. Louis. So I grew up in like a, you know, I now have a lot of friends from, you know, New York and San Francisco and LA. I can't tell you how different growing up in like a suburb of St. Louis is compared to growing up in like a real metropolis. But this was basically the first time I had to show up to something on time and, you know, be responsible for, like, you know, paying attention to something and getting paid for it. And I was extremely young when I was doing this, and I was, you know, refereeing, like, you know, cute little goofy, you know, 5-year-olds playing soccer or whatever. You know, I guess the learning from that, if any, was just the first feeling of responsibility. And it was probably the first time that I was sort of, you know, in, you know, overseeing something, maybe, at my probably ripe age of 12, I hadn't really had an opportunity where I was the one who got to blow the whistle and I, you know, made a call when something wasn't obvious. And so I guess having that feeling, it probably gave me the confidence, you know, over refereeing, you know, a couple dozen games or whatever that was, to eventually say, you know, I'm going to just make that call and I'm going to look at that, make that call. And if that parent gets mad at me, you know, I'm going to stand by myself. And I do actually recall a few times where parents got mad at me because I made a bad call, and I probably did make a bad call, and that was hurtful to me.
Parents get so super intense.
They really do. And I didn't have the thickest skin when I was 12. And so I actually do remember that being hurtful. But, you know, I guess if I were to tie that to now, when you do anything, whether it's, you know, starting a company or, you know, making a call in a sports game or whatever it is, like, someone's going to be mad. And anything you do, going back to the idea of being creative, like, you know, someone's going to hate this particular, like, this podcast, someone's going to like it and someone's going to hate it. And you can't be afraid that, you know, not everybody likes everything that you make all the time. And being comfortable with yourself and with what you're building and with what you're doing, or, you know, the things that you're creating, and not worrying that not everybody likes it or thinks it's great. I think that's so important. And I think, you know, that's something that, you know, my skin has definitely thickened over the last year in terms of, you know, knowing what matters to me and knowing what doesn't matter to me, and remembering what the difference there is.
It's pretty crazy that we got to wrap that all up with a soccer ref. I can't believe how many similarities there are from your 12-year-old job, but it's such a fun way to end. I'm so grateful that we got to have you on the show, Jack. What's the best way for everyone listening in to stay up to date with you? And if they're a company who's thinking, oh my God, I've got to get my hands on Lattice, how can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. You can go to our website at latticehq.com. You can also email me directly. I'm jack@latticehq.com. And we'd love to talk to you. So I will be responsive to my email as always. And, you know, feel free to give me a shout.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.